Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Today, we have two impressive ladies joining us from our own research team at New Frontier Data. First up is Senior Director of Industry Analytics, Casey Morrissey. Thank you for joining.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, welcome back. Our second has also appeared on our show before. She is Director of Industry Analytics. Please welcome Dr. Molly McCann.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on. All right, we have a lot to cover, and I'm excited to get your input on and insights on this. Last week, Marijuana Moment reported, marijuana use is more moral than porn, gay relations, and wearing animal fur. According to a new survey by Gallup, it shows the growing acceptance of marijuana consumption as more states legalize. 7 out of 10 respondents said using cannabis is morally acceptable. Dr. Molly McCann, I'll start with you. How do you believe the shift in the culture of zeitgeist impacted the cannabis industry?
I mean, it's been interesting. So Gallup has been doing this, has asked this question for 3 years now. And of course, as you said, this year, 70% of people say that cannabis, they say smoking marijuana is morally acceptable. And in 2018 and 2019, it was 65%. So unfortunately, they haven't been tracking it since before legalization started, because I think that would have been a really interesting, a much more interesting trajectory to follow. I mean, we've seen already in the last few months, and it's what we talked about last time I was on this show, is the fact that cannabis is an essential business now, and it's so mainstream. This is just reflecting that. This is something that's increasingly acceptable alongside increasing use rates over the last several years. And I think we're just going to continue to see more of this as people become more familiar with cannabis and see more cannabis operations, you know, near their home or in their communities, or hear about friends or family who have access to legal cannabis. It's just going to become more normalized.
Yeah. I would just add to that, that, you know, the growing acceptance is really just pushing sales. I mean, people who would never not only like admit to using cannabis, but also who have never actually tried it, the legalization and legitimization that's come from it being called an essential business, and just the growth of the industry in general and people's acceptance is causing more people to try it. You're seeing a shift in the consumer base.
Yeah. I also feel like just so many people have a different, you know, touch point or a different personal story, whether it be like an aunt or an uncle that suffered from glaucoma or suffered from, you know, used it during a cancer treatment. I think that more and more people are finding different, whether it's medical, a lot of it's medical, but just recreational, that they're finding, you know, different social stories that may not be the typical stoner mentality or a teenager in a tattered shirt. So I think that's pretty great.
One of our reports from 2018, we've actually done a few on consumers, and Molly has headed all of these projects, but just sort of trying to archetype the consumer. I think that growing book of archetypes is really reflective of just the changing consumer base and growing acceptance overall. And that growing acceptance is really what's going to propel legal cannabis and support the growth over the next few years.
Yeah. Molly, I heard you mention that the survey specified smoking marijuana. Was it in like all consumption, like as far as edibles or anything else, or was it strictly talking about smoking?
So they didn't clarify, unfortunately. The language that they used, and they compared it to, I think the most comparable thing they ask about on the survey is drinking alcohol. So they ask, is it morally acceptable to drink alcohol or to smoke marijuana? So I think that that's an interesting distinction to make, because I would suspect that maybe the phrase using cannabis, or specifically like, you know, treating an illness with cannabis, would probably get a really different response. And the fact that, I mean, smoking marijuana, there's a lot to be said about the term marijuana, and there's a lot of discussion about whether it's a racist term, you know, all of the baggage that comes along with it. And then using the word smoking, I think people associate that with something that's a little bit more on the recreational side generally.
Yes. Or just taboo in general, just as far as health claims, you know, you can't smoke a cigarette within 25 feet of a door in a lot of cities, you know, and just smoking in general, I feel like.
Yeah. So it's especially notable that 70% of people have agreed with this being morally acceptable, because I think it's phrased, and, you know, as I design a lot of surveys, and if, you know, I would think really carefully about the words to use, and I would suspect that this phrasing would get the least amount of acceptance of all of the possible ways that you could phrase it.
If you phrase it as consuming cannabis, that could also, people would answer that maybe if they use CBD products or topicals or like anything medical, they would consider that as part of cannabis and then answer the question differently. So yeah, I agree. I think we would see very different results if that question was phrased differently.
Yeah, so they definitely could have gotten even higher numbers, but they phrased it in a way that probably would have gotten low, but it's still looking at 70%. It's great.
Yeah, and even that number itself is vastly underreported because for states that don't have legalization or no legal markets that are active, people are much less likely to admit that they use cannabis. So we consider the SAMHSA numbers to be underreported, or we consider them to be on the low end.
Got it. Well, how do you think, as far as operators in the industry, how can they take advantage of this acceptance?
I mean, continue consumer education efforts, continue to develop product forms for people who maybe aren't already on board with smoking marijuana, right? People who might be more interested in edible forms, which are usually a common way for people who haven't smoked before to first experiment with all cannabis, but especially higher THC cannabis. Continuing to reach out to this growing group of people who maybe never would have considered using it before because they didn't think it was acceptable and now are coming around to thinking it's acceptable, but might still be put off by some of the more traditional uses, forms, applications.
Yeah, I think the change in consumer base is really what operators should be focusing on and utilizing data such as New Frontier data, where we're doing a lot of consumer research to try and understand what those consumer groups look like, what type of products they're using, that as this consumer base is growing, operators can really take advantage of that by targeted marketing and doing those sorts of things.
Yeah. On our last episode, we had Roz McCarthy and we were talking about, you know, in different communities, how it's perceived, you know, and especially in the Black community, how it's always been more of like the dark side of, you know, cannabis and how it's ruined people's lives and how I feel like putting this positive light on it and how it's going to be actually a positive thing in people's life and obviously in legal markets. I think that's a great way also just to focus on the positivity that comes out of cannabis.
I think that hesitation for some ethnic groups also has to do with the way that cannabis is enforced in our criminal justice system as a whole. That if you're in a community that's, you know, disproportionately targeted for smaller crimes like cannabis, that you have older people, like your family is much less likely to be supportive of something that they've seen people go to jail for in their community at a much higher than other communities. So.
And that was reflected in the Gallup poll, actually. They broke down white versus non-white opinion on this. And I think it was 73% of white people said it was morally acceptable and 64% of non-white people. So there is still that stigma. And I think that's connected to experiences of non-white people, right? There's been a lot more, I think a lot of non-white people over the last several decades either have themselves been targeted for cannabis use or know someone who has been arrested, incarcerated for cannabis use. So there it's much more risky for non-white people still to be associated with cannabis.
And even if those groups are consuming cannabis, I feel like for those same reasons would be much less likely to admit use in a survey situation because they're afraid or wouldn't want to be persecuted for that. So
yeah.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, I feel like that's only going to be getting better, it seems like, with more states legalizing, more education going on, and just people kind of, like I said, shining a light on the more positive aspects of marijuana, I feel like will be great. Mm-hmm. All right, we are going to switch gears a little bit. Moving on to CNN reported that DOJ whistleblower to testify that Barr's personal anti-marijuana sentiment fueled cannabis industry investigations. So obviously we know cannabis is at this, still dealing with the federally illegal and legal within states. There's been reports that the DOJ apparently targeted the cannabis industry, individual states declaring the same businesses as essential. And basically they're saying that it's because of Attorney General Barr's personal feelings about the cannabis industry. However, as discussed earlier, cannabis consumption is becoming more popular nationally. Molly, I'll start with you. How do you think this administration's approach to the cannabis industry has impacted the trajectory of the industry?
I mean, we know that the end of 2019 was not kind to a lot of businesses in the cannabis industry and investment in general. So I think that, you know, it's hard to tell how directly, I mean, and this is not my area of expertise to know exactly how directly all of this impacted, you know, the DOJ activity impacted it. But I'm sure that I'm sure it contributed to a lot more, you know, hesitation around investment and concerns about big, you know, M&A activity.
They let a lot of waiting periods expire on some big acquisitions in the industry, which halted money, completely chilled off temperatures about growth in the industry, and really impacted the public markets and flow of capital.
Yeah, I think they mentioned MedMen being the potential Starbucks of marijuana, of the cannabis industry.
They had some major cash flow issues. They were not spending. They had some major issues with their balance sheets that that had a few more reasons behind it, but. But in general, the guidance from the top and the DOJ has not been good. And when it comes to large flows of capital in the public markets, that's what people look to. That's their indicator as to whether or not to invest. If you're looking at like a price target for a public company and you know that you're pricing in an acquisition that is supposed to happen and then a waiting period on that acquisition expires and it no longer happens, that completely crashes your valuation of that company and you wouldn't want to invest in it because you're basing your idea that this company is going to increase their sales because they're acquiring another business, maybe with new dispensaries in a different state. And when they're blocking these sorts of major deals and transactions, it just doesn't send good signals to people who are trying to invest in the industry. It's not necessarily a reflection of demand for cannabis, as we all know that. There's a vast illicit market. People aren't going to stop wanting cannabis. But as far as investment into public companies, it makes a big difference when the DOJ does stuff like that. So.
Now, what would you say are some of the potential consequences of this friction between the federal enforcement and evolving national attitudes?
I mean, this is what we're talking about with the Gallup poll too. There's this growing divide between the position of most politicians and the political establishment and where consumers and non-consumers, where Americans' opinions are. And eventually that's going to, you know, that rift is going to get far enough apart that there's some major action. I mean, even if legalization doesn't happen this year through as many states at the state level that we're looking at, I think that it's quite possible that politicians will be put into office who have new ideas, different ideas about cannabis. And then that could, you know, for 2021 and on, that could, you know, lead to some major policy changes.
Yeah, I feel like going into an election year, the economy where it is, places that it is legalized, what they're seeing in their local economies, I feel like this is kind of seems like a no-brainer going forward, like as far as legalizing and opening this up.
And there are 16 states currently that are planning to have some form of cannabis legalization, whether it's medical or adding an additional recreational market to their state, that have those on the ballot. So we're looking at a potential 16 new markets, either med or rec, if they all happen to pass. And if the 2016 presidential election was anything to go on, only one of all of the states that had initiatives on the ballot didn't pass, and that was Arizona.
Well, yeah. And our economy wasn't in the position it is now. Yeah. Desperate for an influx of cash and jobs and
As you've seen in the headlines over the last year, all the new markets that have opened have really hit blockbuster numbers. Illinois, crazy. Yeah, being like their first month sales. Seeing what's happened in Oklahoma with their medical market and their lack of restrictions on qualifying conditions and that sort of thing. Just seeing an explosion in those markets and then all of the publicity surrounding the tax dollars and sales at this point in time when the economy is really hurting, I think is only going to bode well for legalization come November.
And that's driving the acceptance that we talked about before too, right? I mean, one of the major things that, you know, before we had a few years of data on those first markets to legalize, there was a lot, prohibitionists were trying to scare everyone by saying, you know, here are all of the negative things that could happen, that could come of this. And now we have years of data and those things didn't happen. So I think people now can say, oh, well, this is, you know, we feel like it's more safe in terms of use. We feel like it's safe in terms of creating jobs and stable industries. And yeah, as you're saying, especially now with the economy the way that it is, I don't think people are afraid of it, you know, for the reasons that they were in the past.
Yeah. And not even being afraid of it, they're craving it, even if they're maybe not up and on board, just the job opportunity that could be coming to their local market is huge.
And the specific indicators that they were looking at as possible negatives had to do with like increasing use rates for youth, increased traffic fatalities, things like that. And those are the things that really just didn't bear out. So it becomes harder to argue against legalization when you have those types of tax dollars. And then also the idea that you're eroding the illicit market in your state, which is really the goal of all of these legal programs is to try and hack away at that illegal market.
Yeah, I know. I know. I've personally had conversations now that I'm in the cannabis industry, just having conversations with other mothers in my neighborhood. They're shocked and, you know, like, oh, how can you do that? You know, and I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, have you ever heard of a domestic violence issue with involving cannabis? You know, have you ever heard of like violent crimes happening in involving cannabis? No. And so
not in the legal market.
Yeah, legal markets. I mean, I feel like it's going to take some time for a lot of people to adopt and get on board with it. But I think just getting information out there and having that data in there for the markets that have been around for a while are going to be really telling for new markets coming out and having less fear, which will be great. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up just as far as final thoughts on, and I would love to hear both of your opinions on the current administration's approach to the cannabis industry.
It's a big question. I think the main takeaway for me from the DOJ story with Barr and, you know, using the antitrust, you know, in creative ways is that as Attorney General, he has a much more direct, clear way to go after cannabis, right? Cannabis is still a Schedule I substance under the Controlled Substances Act. And you know, like Sessions would or did, Barr could have gone after cannabis operators because they're violating the CSA, right? But he decided to do it, seems allegedly decided to do it in this other, much less direct way. And to me, that speaks to what we've been talking about this whole time, which is the fact that it would be incredibly politically unpopular for him to go after it that way. So, you know, there's still stigma. The industry is not being treated like other industries. This industry is under a lot of scrutiny, but, you know, it's not politically feasible to just go right after cannabis in the way that, you know, it was just a few years ago.
Yeah, they have to be a little bit quieter about the way that they're doing it just because of the public opinion. And you can see some of how they're doing that with it. We put a piece out last week on civil asset forfeiture related to cannabis and how much is seized without crimes being charged against a person. And it's more that the crime is charged against the stuff and not the person. And we've seen that like the lowest percentage of actual charges come with cannabis. So they're using cannabis as a way to take things from people and give funds to the federal program.
And to fund police.
And which then if effectively through the federal equitable sharing program goes back, 80% of that can go back to local law enforcement where they can bypass their own state's laws on civil asset forfeiture. So, and all of that kind of happens quietly. Like it's not, as we did that research for the piece, it was incredibly difficult to even get any transparency on what individual states were seizing. And then as far as like the federal stuff that was returned to the federal fund, what percentage of that had to do with drugs and cannabis specifically, we had to make a lot of estimations when we were doing that because they're just not clear about it. And I think a lot of that has to do with they knew people would be very angry if it was a public out loud thing.
Got it. All right, cool. Well, we are about out of time. I just want to thank you guys for joining me today. This is a nice short and sweet one. Please be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast. You can find these new stories and more on New Frontier Data's Cannabis Insights Daily. Thank you so much to our guests and listeners for joining us at Canna Week. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and I will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.